Continuing now with hour number two of this weekend's two-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here's the host of the show, Carol Marks, in conversation with John Englander. He's an ocean expert, and he was the CEO of the Cousteau Society and author of High Tide on Main Street, Rising Sea Level, and the Coming Coastal Crisis, published by the Science Bookshelf.
Now, I never knew till I read your book that sea levels have historic cycles of going up and down in temperature, as well as rising up and down 400 feet. So how long has this been going on?
Well, at least 3 or 4 million years in the regular pattern that we call ice ages. And you're right, we tend to be fairly ignorant of it, because for 6,000 years, sea level has been pretty much the same as it is today, which means the shoreline's been where it is. But before that, it went up and down 300 or 400 feet with each ice age. And in fact, we can see very clearly, when we step back and look at the big pattern, that what happened was we were at the turning point. We were at the end of the 20,000-year, roughly, cycle of sea level rising and temperatures warming and ice sheets melting. And we were about to turn the corner into the 80,000-year phase of sea level falling, ice sheets expanding, and temperatures cooling. And what's happened is we've overcome that natural force with the greenhouse gases, and now sea level is rising further than normal. Ice sheets are melting much further than normal, and temperatures are warming.
And I found it just amazing that, you know, we've reached a tipping point. We should be getting cooler, but we're getting warmer, and it's happening 20,000 times faster than it did during other cycles of the sea.
Absolutely. Well, you read the book very well. The temperature's warming about 55 times faster. The greenhouse gases are going up thousands of times, tens of thousands of times faster, as you say, and faster than has happened before when we've had abrupt climate changes. So we're in a period now which is really extraordinary. It hasn't happened in at least 10 million years, and sea level will rise. And we're past the point of that stopping, so we need to do two things, as I conclude. We need to begin adapting to a shoreline that has just started to move inland and will continue to do so decade after decade after decade for centuries. And we need to try and slow that as quickly as we can, within reason.
You are so right. We all have our heads literally in the sand that is going to be going out and not coming back to us because of climate change. Talking about the rising sea levels, because they certainly can cause destructive storm surges, and that happened with Hurricane Sandy. How in the world were you able to describe in your book the scenario that happened during Hurricane Sandy?
It's pretty extraordinary timing, and I'm going to say it's mostly lucky. I mean, a terrible, terribly unlucky event, but the book came out, as you know, a week before Sandy hit, and on page 121, I describe a superstorm hitting Atlantic City and explaining why it would devastate New York. I was just using it as one of a couple of dozen examples to show that we really could have terrible coastal destruction in places we don't normally expect. People think of the Miami or the Maldives Islands or Bahamas or places like that. They don't tend to think of New York as an epicenter, and that just was fortuitous timing, not lucky, but and what I was describing was how four or five things combine to create coastal damage. We've already had a foot of rising sea level in the New York area over a century ago, so the base is a little bit higher. And then, of course, on top of that, we had storm surge. And particularly this storm coming from the southeast piles the water up toward New York Harbor. When the center of the storm hits Atlantic City, the right flank, the stronger flank, would hit Manhattan, which was exactly the example. But then on top of that, when a storm hits at high tide, it makes it even worse by a few feet. And, of course, we have extreme tides, according to the lunar cycles primarily. And, unfortunately, with Sandy, that happened. Sandy hit at a lunar high tide. So we had another couple of feet. And then there's a geologic feature in New York that I was pointing to, which is hidden but makes it even worse. Besides the kind of funneling between Long Island and New Jersey, that brings water to greater heights in New York Harbor. On top of that, there's a long, shallow underwater shelf which would pile up water if a storm came from the southeast, which was the scenario I described. It was a study done in 95. And, of course, unfortunately, all of that came to happen. But it was the best possible illustration to say that coastal damage comes from all four of those things, from slowly rising sea level, from storm surge, from possibly the high tide or extreme tide cycle, and then geographic and topographic situations like New York Harbor that exacerbate the height of the sea level. So all four of those things were at play, and Sandy was just a terrible coincidence that all four were on display 1 week after my book was published, and I described that as a scenario.
Now, one thing that we need to ask ourselves when it comes to the city that we're living on that's near the coast and its vulnerability to storm surges and flooding is what they're built under. And it makes a difference whether the city is built under porous limestone or on granite. And who would think to ask that question?
Exactly. In fact, of course, Al Gore and others have made a lot of explanation about climate change and sea level rise, but that's a point that most have missed. It's not good to compare Miami and Manhattan for exactly that reason, that Miami is on porous limestone, and even if you encircled the city in an impermeable seawall, a steel wall, water would just come up into the middle of the city because it's porous limestone. It's like a sponge. Manhattan's quite different. Manhattan is essentially granite, and it's an impermeable rock. And so not only does the water not come up through the rock of Manhattan, it's solid enough that where there are low spots, it's not a beachfront island, but even where there are low spots of 5 or 10 feet, we can buttress that with a seawall. And so the reality is that 200 years from now, Manhattan will be there in some different configuration, but it will survive at least, I think, a couple of centuries. Whereas Miami has a very different forecast. Miami will not be the city it is today 100 years from now.
Okay. Say I live 20 miles from the water, ocean, so I shouldn't have any damage from the rise of the oceans and the rivers. Why won't this be true in the future?
Sure, because there's an illusion that distance back from the shoreline is the protection. Of course, it has to do more with elevation, as well as the rock structure we just talked about. But here in South Florida, the beach rises pretty swiftly to probably 10 or 15 feet right behind the beach. But then it drops off down to the intercoastal waterway, and it gets actually lower out toward the Everglades. So 5 miles back here, even probably 10 miles back, actually makes you more vulnerable than in the ridge right behind the beach. That's one problem. But all over the world, from Boston to Sacramento, even to Washington, D.C., there are low-lying areas that may be accessed by tidal rivers. So it's more of a, you really have to look at the elevation in detail and see if there are sources connected to the ocean, like a river that moves up and down to the tide, that would be affected by rising sea level.
Now let's talk about what we can do, because the sea is going to rise and continue to rise. And as you said a little earlier, there are some things, you call them intelligent adaptation. And one of the steps you advocate is that local, state, and federal governments discourage people from building oceanfront homes. So what are some of the things that they need to do? They won't be popular, but they need to be done.
You know, there's already $60 billion been allocated to rebuild from Sandy, and undoubtedly it'll be more than that. We may or may not be able to rebuild from storm damage. That's a question of public policy, but we're already having trouble doing that. It's tough to scrape together $60 billion to balance the federal budget even before natural disasters. But sea level rise is going to change everything, because sea level rise is universal. It hits every coastal city in the world. And on top of that, it's essentially permanent. When sea level rises, it won't go down for at least 1,000 years, probably a lot longer than that. So it's a permanent change, and we're not used to that. The fact is, there's no way that governments can afford to reimburse us. I think what we have to do is the opposite. We have to slowly, or as quickly as possible, phase out subsidizing coastal flood insurance. I think we have to tell people that while we may help them in an unexpected storm event in a certain area, that if it's sea level rise damage, which has already started to happen in some places, that the government will have limited means to reimburse them. Because no government has enough money to reimburse citizens and businesses for coastal damage from sea level rise. And we're just not used to it, as you said. It's something the first time in thousands of years we tend to confuse it with storm surge. It's not. But there are some examples already. In Larchmont, Virginia, as I point out in the book, they've already had to raise, I think it's a half dozen houses at the cost of like $140,000 each, which was paid for by the federal government as a reimbursement, because their streets flooded a couple of days a month. And in Miami, there's a road they've had to raise a few feet. In the Florida Keys, a similar situation, where a couple of days a month at extreme high tide, that the roads are awash. Well, so it's already happening, and we have to distinguish storm damage from rising sea level damage. We're going to need some policy changes.
And people will have to read your book because you talk about some of the other steps that we can take to help our cities and coastal attractions that will be prone to sea rise level, like you talk about, to help the bridge in San Francisco. What would you do? Have a dike?
Well, I think so. I think, you know, if you just fast forward and try and imagine the world 100 years from now, we won't be here, but, I mean, our kids and grandkids may be. And I think that once sea level has risen 3, 4, 5 feet, and with the clarity that it's going to keep rising decade after decade for centuries, I think we'll do some extraordinary things, some really amazing civil engineering. We might take areas like the Chesapeake or San Francisco Bay or Boston Harbor or the Mediterranean or the Baltic Sea, places where there are relatively narrow mouths or necks, and turn them into bays with some large locks or dikes and sea walls, and that's possible. I mean, it'll take us decades, and there'll be huge engineering challenges, but they would preserve so much land at the current sea level, and they would also allow us to do some things with the fresh water supplies, the rivers that come into them. We could probably use that fresh water. So while I don't have the answer of exactly how to do that, I was just posing the idea that as we look forward to ever-rising sea levels, or ever-rising, but for centuries, we're going to need to do some civil engineering, and therein lies some opportunity. We're going to create some great things. But as soon as we realize what's staring us in the face, that the shoreline is moving inland and sea level's rising, we will do some great things. There will be some losses, but like anything, if you can see what's coming on the horizon, you can begin to plan better, and you can make investments that will have a good positive return on investment, as opposed to keep having to write off the investment, not knowing where things are headed.
John Englander in conversation with Carol Marks. The book is titled High Tide on Main Street, Rising Sea Level and the Coming Coastal Crisis, published by the Science Bookshelf. For more information, go to hightideonmainstreet.com. You're plugged into A Touch of Gray. And now Carol Marks speaks with Ms. Sam Dawson. She's a philanthropist, an activist, an actor, and a retired publicist, and the author of a book titled Broad Appeal, Wit and Wisdom from Women Ages 60 to 90, published by Abbott Press.
Now, you say you were motivated to write the book when you turned 60 because you were experiencing that over-the-hill phenomenon. What were some of the things that bothered you?
Well, it was mostly physical changes at that time. You know, when you turn 60, things start to head south. And I do a lot of yoga, and when I'm in the down dog yoga position, I could count the rings on my legs, you know, like the tree rings on a, like the age rings on a tree, and my started fading away, and I just didn't like turning 60 at all. I had in mind 50, but boy, 60 was just a big mark for me. And right now, honestly, Carol, I would give a dental implant to be 60 again. It was a great time.
Now, when you turned 68, though, your whole attitude about aging, you know, was so different. So what caused that?
You know, I'm not sure, but sometime right after 65, I just became much freer, and sort of the oughts, coulds, woulds, and shoulds of life just sort of melted away, and I thought, what the heck? I mean, this is a chance. I would been grousing about it for quite a while, and I thought, I wonder how other women feel. And so I just said, I'm going to give it a shot. So I set out to interview a bunch of women. I interviewed over 70 women for this book, and really found out that a lot of them felt just like me. We just don't think, feel, or act old. And I think you know that, Carol. I mean, you've been talking about this for a long time.
Now, how did you go about finding the women that you interviewed?
Well, first I just you know, I was such an innocent. I had no idea that this would be over almost a four-year odyssey. I thought it would be so simple. But I just sort of sent out an email and I said, gee, if you're over 60, will you write for me? And if you're not, will you send this to your mom or to a friend or someone you know that's over 60? And I fooled around with that for about a year, and really I found that women were intimidated to write. But once I said, I'll interview you, everybody raised their hand. They said, oh, sure, you can interview me. And so I mean, I could have kept going. I probably could have done 150 women. They were all anxious to share as long as they didn't have to write it down themselves.
I don't
know. So, yeah, that's how it worked.
Now, one of the questions you asked the women you interviewed was, what surprised them about getting older, and what are a few of the main points they made, and did any of the things that they said surprise you?
Well, they did surprise me because, well, I thought I was the only one that, you know, always is like 10 years behind whatever age I'm supposed to be. But all the women really sort of felt like this. They just don't feel or act old, and they're different than their parents, because I think that the generation of at least my parents, and I'm now over 70, so I'm not quite a baby boomer, you know, I'm that generation a little bit before, but we're the hot generation. I mean, they call us the silent generation, but we're the ones that, you know, burned our bras and really made way for the boomers to come in. And what surprised me was that all of the women felt like I did. They really don't feel or act old, and they're not rocking chair grannies. They're out there doing things. They're alive. They're excited. They're filled with, wanting to exercise, wanting to learn, wanting to do new things, and that made me feel so good. It really was inspiring.
And you also questioned the woman you spoke to about what is great about their current age. And in a number of years, I'll be moving into my 80s, and I wouldn't want to be any younger, because it wasn't until I got older I got more relaxed, and I stopped wasting all my time following the latest trends and moving with the so-called in-group. Any comments about that?
Yes, I'm so with you on that one. I think that what we've discovered as we've gotten older is that we're more interesting, we're more interested in the world, we're bold, we speak our minds, and we've let go, and I don't know why it takes so long, but we let go of the sort of the toxic people in our lives, and that's certainly one thing that I would love to see younger women do earlier. You know, that we, for some reason, once you're over 60, you start to say, hey, you know, what do I need those people in my life for? Why don't I just hang out with happy, hang out with positive? And really, I mean, it's been shown scientifically that the people over 60 are basically way happier than the younger ones. Maybe it's because we don't have the same kind of obligations that we had to when we were younger. We've raised our families. We've done our careers. The obligations we take on are ones we choose rather than ones we have to have.
It's so freeing to do that.
Isn't it? Yeah, it really is. And so we're less a work in progress. You know, we are who we are. And it's pretty cool, I think. Happily.
I agree. Now, I think humor is the most helpful ingredient we can have as we age. And you have a lot of humor in your book, and you quote one woman, Teresa, I love what she said, I accept the change so long as I can function, I don't care, I want to be able to walk and feel good, I'll buy looser outfits if I have to, and date nearsighted men. See, I never thought about that.
Well, it's true. Well, you know, and also, you know, one woman said that, you know, she didn't mind getting older. She just wished she could do it wrinkle-free, which, you know, I think we'd all would have loved that. But and another gal said that when she smiles, the wrinkles, you know, they go away and they turn into a big smile. So she just smiles a heck of a lot more than she used to. So, you know, that's what it takes.
And as you write in your book, as you grow older, you can have fabulous new beginnings, and volunteering is certainly one of them. How does helping others help the person who's doing it? And can you tell us about the organization you helped to found, Impact Giving?
Oh, and I'd love to. That's one of my favorite subjects. First of all, let me say something. One thing about volunteering, and I'm sure you know this, that we set out to volunteer when we have time because we think we're going to help all those poor people or whoever that is, that, you know, we're going to give our time and they're going to benefit. And what we discover is, as we volunteer, that the people that are helped the most are the volunteers. Because when you give back, you just realize how terrific you feel. So you set out to help other people and you really help yourself. So I'm a huge proponent of volunteering. And thank you for asking about Impact Giving, because what we are is a women's collective giving organization. And our goal is rather audacious, but if anybody out there is listening and they would like to become part of it, we'd love to have them. It's women that together, collectively, they all put in $1,000 a year. And then that money collectively is given out and once a year through a granting process. And in our first 3 years in existence, we have granted $345,000 to 20 local and global organizations. So that's pretty good. That's a brand new funding source for nonprofits. And so we're always looking to grow. We're about 140 women strong now, and we're hoping this year to get to 200, so we can give out $200,000 this year. So that's the plan.
That's Ms. Sam Dawson in conversation with Carol Marks, and her book is titled Broad Appeal, Wit and Wisdom from Women Ages 60 to 90, published by Abbott Press. For more information, go to impactgivingnow.org. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engines.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, as we come to the final half hour of our big two-hour weekend get-together here, and we're joined by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who just a moment from now will be talking with Allison Paquin. She's a clinical pharmacist at the VA Boston Healthcare System, and they're going to talk about ways seniors with cognitive disabilities can avoid medication errors, which is a pretty serious topic. And, Richard, how's your eyesight lately in reading the small print?
Well, I'll tell you what, the small print that's starting to get to me now is the menus at restaurants, especially dimly lit restaurants.
It's funny, I could talk about dimly lit restaurants for, I mean, and sometimes it's easy on the eyes, but it makes you wonder, like, did they dust?
the place what does clean? The food really look like?
Yeah. What does that woman across the table really look like? What do I really look like? But, you know, yeah, but what about dimly lit restaurants concerns you?
Well, it's now becoming very fashionable, especially with my wife, to check out the nutritional information on anything before we eat. And I don't know about you, but when I go out to eat, it really bothers me to know how many calories are in a given meal, you know?
Well, you're a sportsman. You're in perfect condition. You burn that stuff. You don't have to worry about that. You're an Adonis. You're a former ballet star who still occasionally works out.
No.
On the other hand...
Seriously, when I go out to eat, I want to have a good time eating, and I don't want to really think... You know, I'll think, okay, I don't want to eat something like cheesecake, really fattening, but every once in a while you just want to indulge. And if you go to a restaurant and you're always looking at nutritional information, doesn't it kind of spoil the fun?
Well, yeah, it does. But then again, so does drinking excessively or engaging in the use of, you know, banned substances. The fact of the matter is you're right. It does ruin it. But I have the same thoughts, but it doesn't ruin it the way it's being ruined for you. It ruins it for me by letting me know that everything is fattening. Everything is fattening. When I go to these restaurants, I wind up having to find out that things that I think are not fattening are fattening, like chicken. You know, you have a piece of broiled or baked chicken with a Caesar salad, and it's over 1,000 calories. You go, what? It's a salad.
Well, exactly. A salad, like a Caesar salad, you think, okay, it's just some romaine lettuce,
right.
A couple of croutons, maybe a little olive oil. How bad could it be? Maybe some anchovies? It turns out that it can be very bad in terms of calories.
Yeah, and bread, you know, I buy the 45-calorie a slice bread.
Which is mostly air.
It's mostly, yeah, exactly. And then I eat 7 slices of it. It's like when I was a smoker, and thank goodness I haven't smoked in almost, I'd say about 35, 40 years. But I was a heavy smoker. So you were always dealing with the guilt of, oh my gosh, I'm smoking, I'm taking in all this tar and nicotine, and you'd look at the numbers of the cigarettes, and some have less tar and less nicotine than others. And then they came out with cigarettes that were really low. So you'd buy them. And you'd wind up smoking twice as many. So what good does it do? You know,
we went to a very pricey restaurant the other night. We had a coupon, a gift certificate to this restaurant. So we go there, and I'm thinking, all right, this has a lot of fattening things. So I ordered the seafood platter, which was a little lobster tail and a couple of shrimp and a couple of clams. I thought, I'm going to be really good tonight. This is not bad. This is nutritious, not a lot of calories. So what did they do? For bread, they bring you these homemade popovers that are the size of softballs.
Yes. Each popover has to have at least 600 calories.
At least.
And that's without
and
the
of
butter.
Course, you can't just nibble on it. You have to eat the whole thing. It's so good.
And then you want
so
another one.
So there goes your diet.
Oh, it's crazy. But even when you cook at home, everything is very fattening. We are so used to overeating that now we are deprived if we don't do that. And even a glass of orange juice could have a couple of hundred calories. Even low calorie bread, as I mentioned before, a piece of chicken or a piece of beef has a ton of calories. And then if you embellish it, where you put a little oil on it, or you saute it, or you know, heaven forbid, you fry it, you're getting into the thousands of calories in one meal. For a guy like me, I have figured out that it's about 2,100 calories a day, maybe 22, depending upon how active I am. If I eat below that, I lose weight. If I eat that, I maintain. If I eat above it per day, I gain weight. And you can blow out 2,000 calories before lunch with how fattening things are. You know?
Oh, no doubt. You can do that at lunch. I mean, you look at some dishes that you could get at a franchise luncheon place, and you look up and it's 1,800 calories for the main course. That's
right.
Not even considering side dishes.
Right. So think about, you know, how do you get through 3 meals a day and a snack and occasionally something that, is a treat? Like, you ever go on the road trips and you stop at these gas stations where they have snacks for the road,
mm-hmm.
and everything is marked health bars, health food. Read how many calories a teeny little health bar, my eye. I mean, 500 calories. Or they'll play the trick where it's only 200 calories per serving. And the little bag has 3 servings.
Oh, yeah.
A little bag of peanuts, 3 servings.
The store for the homemade muffins section.
Muffins.
And you look at them, and it says 250 calories. And you go, that's not bad. But each muffin is two and a half portions.
Right, exactly. You're going to cut the muffin in half and give it to someone else?
Yeah, right.
Fast. Okay, we've got to take a break. We're going to hear you talk to the pharmacist. and then you're going to come back, and I want to talk more about this. It's very interesting. Richard Neer, up next, talking about how seniors with cognitive disabilities can avoid medication errors. That's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, as promised, here's Richard Neer in conversation with Allison Paquin. She's a clinical pharmacist at VA Boston Healthcare System, and she's going to talk to Richard about ways seniors with cognitive disabilities can avoid medication errors.
Obviously, as you get older, Allison, we know that cognitive things happen, not necessarily in a good direction, and I'll tell you, even at my age, it's very, very difficult to keep track of medications. Give us some tips on how you can get this so that it becomes part of your routine and it just happens kind of automatically, or is that even possible?
Yeah, well, you know, the first point you mentioned is right on. It's very hard to take medications for any of us. People of all ages struggle with this. But the older adults are at they're more vulnerable population because they take more medications. They also have more complex regimens. One thing that I can recommend is really tips for caregivers. So you mentioned developing a system and a routine to help patients take medicine safely, and this is exactly what we recommend when we see patients in our geriatrics clinics. Coming up with structure is very helpful to the lives of those with cognitive difficulties. One example might be setting up a pillbox to organize medications.
And same time every day, I think, probably would be important. Wouldn't it be you want to try to get into a routine where everything is very familiar and it happens at the same time?
Yes, routine is very helpful. So even if you can associate taking a medicine with something you do every day to keep yourself on track, that can be very, very helpful. It's also best to take medicines around the same time every day so your body gets used to them.
Yeah, and of course there are different instructions with different medications. Some of them are best taken with meals. Some of them are best taken between meals. How do you keep all that straight?
That can be very challenging. You're right. Some medicines are taken multiple times a day. They have to be spaced from food. One key person you can talk with is your pharmacist. So they are the medication expert. If you ever have questions or if caregivers have questions about how to best organize the medicines or space them throughout the day, talk with that pharmacist.
Now, are there other reminders? I mean, if somebody isn't a full-time live-in caregiver, are there any kind of programs on the computer or any kind of setups you can do with an organization that will call to remind or automatically send an alarm when it's time to take the pills?
You know, I don't have any knowledge of specific programs that are out there, but the alarms are certainly something that we recommend for our patients. Even setting alarms on things like phones, that can be helpful. The other thing caregivers can do is just make sure that medication list is up to date. So that's very important, so that all the doctors know what the patient is taking or what they might be having trouble with.
And how involved should caregivers actually get with the doctors themselves? Because I know a lot of times if the person goes to a doctor and they're told things, they forget them, they don't write them down. Is it important for the caregivers actually sometimes to go to the doctor's appointments with the person they're taking care of?
It is. It's very important. You know, that extra set of eyes and ears is helpful to make sure information doesn't get lost by the time you leave the doctor's appointment and then go home and try to incorporate these medicines into your system. So I do think going to those appointments can improve the safety of medication taking.
And I would think also on the other side of the information giving, the person who is taking the medications might not exactly tell the truth, maybe not for any nasty reason, but because they don't remember a symptom that they might experience or because they don't want to, they want to appear stoic. And it's often up to the caregiver to say, well, you are having a problem. You are urinating more frequently than you should or something along those lines.
You're right. The caregiver has all of that key information. And it may be, for a couple reasons, the patient may not be able to relay it, either because of their memory-type difficulties or cognitive difficulties. And then the other piece is oftentimes they want to please the doctor. You know, they want to say that they're taking something. So I think the caregiver does have key information that will help the doctors and the pharmacist and the whole team make the best assessment.
Do you see any future technology on the horizon or anything that might help along these lines?
You know, I think some of the things you mentioned as far as better systems for helping people take medications, things to dispense medications to the patient at their home, things like that may be able to play a role.
Yeah, you would think so because, you know, not to take humans down to the level of animals, but they do have things that for dogs where the water is automatically dispensed at certain times. And I would think there would be some kind of technology where you could have a hopper with certain pills in it that would just come down at a certain time and the person would be able to do that. Maybe that's a good business for you to get into, Allison.
Like you mentioned, the machines, they may be able to help a little bit, but nothing can really replace having that pharmacist there to talk to. Use that pharmacist as a resource because they are the medication experts, and I don't know how much those machines will be able to tell us about how to take medications or if they're safe for us.
That is true. Okay, is there a website where we can get more information about this?
There is. The website I want to share is called safemedication.com, and there's some tips on that site for the safe use of medicines, and there's also a tool called My Medicine List to get you started with creating that medication list.
That's Doctor of Pharmacy Allison Paquin in conversation with Richard Neer, our senior correspondent. For more information, go to safemedication.com. Richard returns for some final words when we hit the final segment of our two-hour get-together here on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, in just a moment.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we are at the final segment of our two-hour get-together and continue our ongoing conversation with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Interesting conversation with the pharmacist, Richard, and I want to get back to what we were talking about. I've been thinking about it while you were doing that. When I put my mind to it, I lose weight. So it can be done, but I do think we are addicted. I use that word carefully, but I mean it. I think that we are addicted to food.
Well, you know what? We are going to have a guest on the program soon about the Mediterranean diet. And he tells you what Nutrisystem and a lot of these other diets tell you is that, you know, when we grew up, snacking was bad. You know, don't want to snack. Don't want to eat between meals. Just eat your three meals. Well, now more and more science is in that you should eat frequently because you keep your metabolism going instead of shutting down into the starvation mode. So if you eat actually five or six small meals a day, snacks.
Small, that's the word.
Well, that's a key. Yeah, you can't
five or six pizzas a day.
No, that doesn't work generally, Michael. But if you eat five or six, and you know, you can have normal meals and then little snacks, 100-calorie, 150-calorie snacks, some turkey or maybe some cheese or maybe, you know, something small, you can actually lose weight by eating more frequently.
Yes, my wife is a very, very lean machine. And fortunately for her, she likes food that I consider to be sacrificing. She likes carrots. She likes grapes. You know, she likes stuff like that, lettuce, things of that nature. But she does, so she eats very, very smart. But she also doesn't like big meals. and she grazes. She grazes all the time. In other words, I'll say, why are you eating that? We're going out to dinner in an hour. She goes, no, I don't want to eat a lot at dinner. This keeps me thin. It keeps me going. And she's always snacking on carrots. I say, want some carrots? These are delicious. Look. I go, no. She eats carrots the way I would eat potato chips.
Well, yeah, see, that's the problem. You should eat the carrots and not the potatoes. But she's actually right, because if you do eat a snack before you go out for a meal, then you look at the menu, you know, I'm not that hungry. You're not going to order that big thing with a lot of calories.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, this is a major industry in this country. It is a major issue. And we're caught between a rock and a hard place. We are becoming increasingly aware of the value of eating healthily, and we also are becoming fatter and fatter as a society. How do you account for that dichotomy, for that contradiction?
Well, I think it's the whole supersize thing. I think it's the portion size.
Portion sizes, yeah.
Back in the day, the portions were smaller. Now we have these bigger portions, and we think, well, we're eating the same food, but we're actually eating more of it. And unless you actually weigh the food and check into the caloric content, you don't really know how many calories you're getting.
Well, one of the hot issues right now is, of course, Mayor Michael Bloomberg's, you know, campaign to make it illegal to have the supersized sodas in New York. And I think he's been, you know, overruled by
the courts,
by proponents of freedom, that it's wrong. He's right, but he's wrong legally. But he's right in terms of, you know, science and biology. It's not his role to tell us what to eat, though. But the fact of the matter is that a 12-ounce soda was considered a lot of soda when I was a kid. 16-ounce came along. I remember in Brooklyn, Triple Cola, and there was Royal Crown Cola. They had the 16-ounce bottles. That was considered outrageous. And the kind of sizes they have now were called family size, and the whole family would drink from the bottle. Now, each kid has what we had when we were kids were for the whole table, for families. We're out of time. Richard, fascinating stuff. Look forward to talking to you next weekend. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Neer, one of our senior correspondents on A Touch of Gray. Beverly Santanello, our producer on the front line, thank you very much. Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program, we salute you for your fine work. Steve Wiseman and Kevin Casey, the entire Touch of Gray broadcast team, Michael Harrison here, inviting you to join us next weekend for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.